want to break into the system.
Someone without access to the exam.
I have been doing a little hacking in here, as a matter of fact.
Computers and the programs will start thinking, and the people will stop.
I still don't understand why you want to break into the system.
Because, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I got in for it, I could reconstruct it.
Everyone, welcome to the July 25th edition of the In and Out Show. This is your host, Slip Mode, along with trusty sidekick,
Bior.
And also,
Cyber Bob.
All right, we'll be seeing a lot of Cyber Bob because Cyber Bob lives with Slip Mode. So
Cyber Bob is now Slip Mode's house person.
Person.
He keeps me chained up in the basement. Please help me.
No, actually, I keep them chained to AOS and Messenger. All right. Well, how's everyone doing?
Fantabulous.
Ecstatic with joy.
All right. And VR is on Wi-Fi, so he's going to have delayed reaction. He's going to be watching porn while he does the show. And
because I can't get it anywhere else.
Will there be sound effects?
No.
Thank God.
If you want me to, I can.
No, please don't.
Hey, actually, if you start breathing hard, put the mic just a little bit to the side. Okay, all right. Well, we had a small get-together at the place last night. Had a lot of people, show up at the Casa, and some 2,600 folk. Watched some interesting movies. Watched the DVD of Freedom Downtime. Did quite a few things. It's pretty fun. Hope to do it again sometime in the future. All right, well, I spotted this on CNN. It was kind of interesting that they actually had this timeline of hacking, and I thought I'd bring it up and just kind of go over what the timeline's all about and maybe refresh memories or talk about some new things. Actually, there's one thing in here that I read that I didn't really know about. And it goes by pretty much every decade until it gets up to, like, the 80s and the 90s. 1960s, the dawn of hacking. Basically, they're talking about the people over at MIT messing around with code and computers and switches and making things happen in the very beginning stages of computers and electronics. 1970s, the Phone Freaks and Captain Crunch, which actually I have a picture with me, Duel, and Captain Crunch. And, me and Duel described to Captain Crunch what Bukkake was all about. That was exciting. Let's see here. Let me read some of the details. Da-da-da-da-da. Yep, that's the... when John Draper builds the blue box. And, Steve Wozniak. Which, actually, if you go to Default Radio's website, defaultradio.com, then go to the mirror section, and then you'll see White Sword's mirror. If you click on that link, it actually... I would read you the link, but I forget it. Actually, you know what? I can bring it up right now. I'm going to get this link for you. Now, if you want to, you can actually go and listen to Kevin Mitnick's speech and also Wozniak's speech on off this site, which is White Sword's site, where they have where he has the audio files put up there. Okay, pulling it up right now.
So did you and Duel demonstrate Bukkake for Captain Crunch?
Well, we showed a picture of it being demonstrated.
Really?
Yeah, so we didn't demonstrate ourselves, but we showed a picture of it. Okay, you can go to archive.hakt.tk/hope5, using the numeral 5, slash, and then right there in that directory you'll be able to find the Kevin Mitnick keynote. Actually, there's an interview with Kevin in the Wozniak speech. You can check that out. All right, going back here to the history, 1980 hacker message boards and groups. Kind of talked a little bit about that in my Hacker Radio speech, as people spreading the word about hackdom and technology and all that. Let's see, 1983, kids games. So I think that was the beginning of you know, whereas and stuff like that. And
Script kiddies.
Well, no, not script kiddies. Actually, like, breaking the copyright protection on Commodore games, Apple games.
Oh, okay.
Messing with the code, stuff like that. And, yeah, it's when the movie War Games came out. Basically introduces the public to hacking. And also, let's see here. 1984, Hacker Zines. Basically when 2600 first came a regular publication. And 1986, to use a computer and go to jail. In the wake of an increasing number of break-ins into the government and corporate computers, Congress passes the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which makes it a crime to break into computer systems. The law, however, does not cover juveniles. 1988, the first worm, made by Robert T. Morrison, and basically affected a lot of computers out there on the ARPANET, and spread it to about 600 network computers. Or 6,000, sorry. 1989, the Germans and the KGB. In the first cyber espionage case to make international headlines, hackers in West Germany, loosely affiliated with the Chaos Computer Club, are arrested for breaking into U.S. government and corporate computer systems, selling operating system source code to the Soviet KGB. Three of them are turned in by two fellow hacker spies, and a fourth suspect hacker commits suicide when his possible role in the plan is publicized. Because the information stolen is not classified, the hackers are fined and sentenced to probation. Well, that really sucks for the guy that killed himself.
Yeah, no kidding. Poor guy.
In a separate incident, a hacker is arrested who calls himself the Mentor. He publishes a now famous treatise that comes to be known as the Hacker Manifesto. The piece, a defense of hacker annex, begins, "My crime is that of curiosity. I am a hacker, and this is my manifesto. You may stop this individual, but you may not stop us all." And then 1990, Operation Sun Devil. After a prolonged investigation, the Secret Service swoops down on hackers in 14 U.S. cities, conducting early morning raids and arrests. The arrests involve organized or prominent members of BBSs and are aimed at a crackdown on credit card theft and telephone and wire fraud. The result of the breakdown is in the hacker community, with members informing on each other in exchange for immunity. In 1993, why buy a car when you can hack one? Basically, this is back when Kevin Paulson actually messed around with the phone system to only make it so that his call would be able to make it to the radio station to win the Porsche. That was
very cool. I heard about that.
That's brilliant.
It is. It was genius.
During radio station contest, hacker fugitive Kevin Paulson, which actually is now one of the writers over at Security Focus, and two friends rigged the station's phone system to only let their calls through and win two Porsches, vacation trips, and $20,000. Basically, Paulson already wanted for breaking into the phone company system, serves 5 years in prison for computer and wire fraud. Since his release in 1996, he has worked as a freelance journalist covering computer crime. And the first DEF CON...
But the more important thing, was he able to keep the Porsche and take the vacation?
I doubt that.
I think he got a little greedy. I'd have been fine with, like, the $20,000 or maybe a Porsche. But you don't win two Porsches, $20,000, and a few vacations and just leave it all to luck, you know?
No. The first DEF CON hacking conference takes place in Las Vegas. The conference is... it goes over some of the stuff about the conference. And then 1984, Hacking Tools Are Us. Basically, the internet signs off and takes us off in a new browser. Netscape Navigator makes information on the web more accessible. Hackers take to the new venue quickly, moving all their how-to information hacking programs from the old VBSs to the new hacker websites. And 1995, the Mitnick takedown. Basically, Trevor Mitnick is captured by federal agents and charged with stealing 20,000 credit cards and all sorts of other junk. Also, Russian crackers siphon $10 million from Citibank and transfers the money to bank accounts around the world. Vladimir Levin, Levin, which is his last name, I'm not saying the number 11. The 30-year-old ringleader uses his work laptop after hours to transmit the funds and accounts in Finland, to accounts in Finland and Israel. Levin stands trial in the United States and is sentenced to 3 years in prison. Authorities recover all but $400,000 of stolen money. 1997, Hacking AOL. AOL is released, a freeware application that allows a burgeoning community of unskilled hackers or script kiddies to wreak havoc on American online. For days, hundreds of thousands of AOL users find their mailboxes flooded with multiple megabyte mail bombs, and their chat rooms are disrupted with spam messages. That went on for quite a few years. Basically, 1998, Back Office was released at DEF CON. Actually, I was there for that. That was really fun. And also, during heightened tensions in the Persian Gulf, hackers touch off a string of break-ins to unclassified Pentagon Computers and Steel software programs. The U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary John Hammer calls it the most organized and systematic attack on U.S. military systems to date. An investigation points to two American teens, a 19-year-old Israeli hacker who calls himself the Analyzer, a.k.a. Ehud Tenenbaum, is eventually identified as the ringleader and arrested. Tenenbaum is the chief technology officer at a computer consulting firm today. 1999, software security goes mainstream. Basically, in the wake of Microsoft Windows 98 release, 1999 becomes a banner year for security and hacking. Hundreds of advisories and patches are released in response to newfound and widely publicized bugs in Windows and other commercial software products. 2000, service denied. Basically talking about a lot of the DDoS or even DOS attacks that happened. And 2001, DNS attack. Microsoft basically got their DNS attack by lawyers. Microsoft becomes a prominent victim of a new type of hack that attacks the domain name server, and this type and these denial of service attacks the DNS pass then take users to Microsoft's websites are corrupted. The hack is detected within a few hours, but several millions of users were prevented from reaching Microsoft's webpage for 2 days. And also they had that program that distributes the denial of service attack from that worm. Which worm was that?
Which one?
Well, I'm asking you. I forget. Actually, there was a worm, though, that was programmed in there to actually do a denial of service against Microsoft and WindowsUpdate.com. We talked about it on one of those shows.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, there's so many of those things that come out.
Wasn't it Blaster?
I think so. I believe it was. Okay. All right. How's the Wi-Fi, VR? He's not going to participate this whole show.
No, I'm... You know, Windows is, like, hijacked by a machine. It's taken me to some weird place, and... It's not letting me to get out of it.
Microsoft.com, yeah, that's a very weird place.
No, you know, you're probably actually getting hijacked by some spyware you have stuck in your computer that you didn't really realize it from all your previous surfing before you jumped on our Wi-Fi and probably tried to contaminate our entire network here.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Not a problem. My pleasure, actually. It should be really clean because I just redid everything.
Really?
Yeah, I just cleaned it all out.
He was just joking. You can't really contaminate our network.
I really don't care.
Well, I mean, there's always a possibility.
Because I've got this strange, like, welcome to Windows thing that's just completely taken over
my
machine.
Let's do some troubleshooting live here. Let me see this.
All right, this is kind of strange. Now I'm like, I've already told it to shut down, and
it looks like it's booting up.
This is strange. I've never seen this before.
Go to exit.
Well, then... Yeah. The last time I tried to exit, it didn't do anything.
Oh, that looks like the welcome video for installing Windows ME.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, that was beautiful.
Oh, okay. I don't even know how that got
Yes, he is running Windows ME. I apologize on his behalf.
Well, that's why I'm, you know, I hate Microsoft. Because I have to deal with their products.
But he is running Netscape.
He is running Netscape.
Yeah.
Which that actually, which is really strange because every time I, like, about every three out of every four times I do a search, it has an error and it shuts down. And I have to restart it.
Not only is it Netscape.
But I still rather use that than the Microsoft Explorer.
It looks like Netscape 4.
Well, you don't understand is that he actually reloaded his computer. He hasn't had a chance to do anything else. He just restored it off the resource.
Yeah.
Go to Mozilla.org and download Firefox.
Okay. That's why I'm here and borrowing the Wi-Fi card.
Exactly. And then also... you just went with a restore CD, but you could always, I could always help you out and put on like another operating system.
Well, that'd be nice.
So
yeah, like a non-Redmond operating system.
Which is what's really funny is how this thing was set up in the beginning. Is it already has Internet Explorer on it, but if I click on it, it tells me that I need to go register with Gateway .net. And I don't want to register with Gateway.net.
Yeah, Gateway program then.
Because they want to sign me up to their internet service, their dial-up. I don't want it. So I can't even use Microsoft, the Internet Explorer, until I sign up with Gateway.net.
Well, you can. You just have to, that's the homepage. You got to change the homepage.
You have to decline the offer to join Gateway.net.
I have, about five times.
Yeah, it's the homepage. It's the homepage. Most PC makers do that. It's the homepage of the browser.
It's funky.
All right. Well, all right. Too bad you can't build your own laptop.
You can, actually.
Well, it's not widely available to do that.
They're not.
I was thinking about doing it. You know, I would actually like break down and get a briefcase. And I was thinking about, you know, getting a big monitor for it. And, like, Just having it, you know, all the stuff just like crammed into a briefcase. That'd be kind
of cool. Actually one of the guys who showed up to one of the 2600 meetings. He actually lives in LA. He comes to them once in a while. He has a laptop that he built. They're called White Boxes, I think.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've seen that you can get on there. You have to. There's only like a few places that do it. There's
yeah, I think Asus is actually the only one that makes parts for it.
Is it any good?
Yeah, they're great. They're a lot cheaper too.
Ooh, White Box.
Yeah.
Let's check that out.
Yeah, yeah. You can check
go
it out.
Go for it.
All right. Well, while you're working on that, basically, and we'd like to bring these interesting things up. The Apollo 11, the first flight to the moon, has got a 35-year anniversary.
Wow, 35. And we haven't been back since.
No, but we're on our way back. But we've been a lot other for places that are much farther,
yeah.
Actually. Not landing on them, but flying out there with our various satellites and probes and capabilities, and also the rovers out there on Mars doing a really good job.
I remember one time I was reading this story about this probe that they sent out to basically orbit a comet for like 20 years and just gather information. And it finally ran out, and so they decided, well, you know what? We might as well just try and land on the comet and see what other information we can get. And actually landed a spacecraft on a comet.
That's pretty cool.
Yes, it is.
Well, we talked about that.
Actually, it was more space probe than spacecraft, did we?
We talked about that.
That's probably where I heard about it.
I don't know if they did land it. I think there was something we were talking about that they wanted to land it.
No, I remember.
Well, there was a comment a while back where they actually had one of the probes actually crash into it.
Really?
Yeah, and actually then they had another one that was analyzing what kind of came out. It was kind of interesting. Because they were doing several different kinds of tests on it. I don't remember everything anymore.
All right. And then moving right along, just want to mention that small tidbit. And actually, I have a pinball machine that's in the room that's based on the Apollo 11 landing. eBay dips its toes in online music. Basically, the online auctioneer is running a six-month test to decide whether it wants to get into the market. Beyond music, eBay is using the pilot to help decide whether to introduce a digital downloads category for other media. So they're going to be working on that to see if they want to get in that market or not.
Does that mean that you'll be able to bid on downloading MP3s?
No, I think it's just a music
store. Just another download service.
Yeah, I think it's just a music store. All right. And in other technological news, this is actually pretty interesting. SGI has always come up with very innovative ways and systems and stuff like that, innovative ways to do things and systems that they have. To run their computers, kind of like Sun has some pretty interesting things up their sleeve, but they've recently switched over to Intel and no longer really getting into development of their processors, which I was kind of upset about, just because it gives more of a variety of interesting processors out there. Basically, the SGI is building a supercomputer to scale to 1,024 computers, well, processors. July 15th, Silicon Graphics Incorporated is building its Altix supercomputer for the National Center for Supercomputing Applications that will run a single Linux operating system across image across 1,024 Intel Corp Itanium 2 processors and 32 terabytes of shared memory. With the new Altix machine, researchers will have far more computing power for their work, which includes weather data analysis, simulations of black hole collisions, and other large-scale events in the evolution of the universe. Initially, Pentagon said the system will use two images of Linux, one per 512 processors while it's being tested and configured later. All 1,024 processors will address one image of the SGI Advanced Linux operating system, which is based off of the Red Hat Enterprise Linux. Also, the system, which is being called Cobalt, is a symmetric multiprocessor machine that will connect to a 370 terabyte SGI infinite storage shared file system, according to these people.
How many terabytes?
370. The construction of the Cobalt began with the delivery of a storage equipment last month, and the machine is expected to be fully online by March 1st. It will be a potential peak performance power with more than 6 trillion floating point operations per second, which will bring the total computing power of NCSA to more than 35 teraflops and disk storage to 0.75 petabytes. SGI uses a proprietary NUMAFlex shared memory architecture that allows memory to be shared across multiple commodity processors, and SGI ProPack for Linux, an application package that allows Linux to scale to larger requirements, according to a statement from the company.
What are they going to do with that many terabytes of data?
they're going to do...
Read everybody's email.
They're going to do this. Weather data analysis, simulations of black hole collisions, and other large-scale events in the evolution of the universe.
Are they really going to need that much storage? Because, I mean, last time I heard about it, the Library of Congress, which is like every written document in America, was like 7 terabytes.
Well, to do weather analysis to any, like, any degree of accuracy, you need more power.
Yeah, the amount of variables that you're taking into...
Well, power, definitely. I can agree with that, but...
Well, you need
storage?
Actually think about...
Well, why do you have the power? To process lots of data.
Because really to get, you know, if you really want to get accurate weather, you know, forecasting to, like, you know, more than a month out, you're really going to have to track atoms and their movement and their temperature for weeks.
That is insane.
To really do good, accurate meteorology.
I feel sorry for the dude who has that job.
Yeah.
Actually, that guy that does it is probably very happy that he has that machine.
Yeah.
It's really going to advance the stuff that he's working on.
And well, so yeah, really what they're trying to do is they have a couple of weather stations and they mm-hmm. try to correlate all the data that comes into it
mm-hmm.
and, you know, then predict in the future. They have whole models that they have to run, and then if one's actually doing well, then, you know, they run many models. And if one's actually being accurate, then they go with that one and project it. Kind of interesting process.
That is. It sounds very interesting.
And actually, Stephen Hawking's on the whole black hole thing just changed his mind about black holes.
The Hawking hole.
I thought that was really cool. And it makes so much more sense.
Well, yeah. Why don't you tell the listeners what you're talking about?
Well, that he said that, before, they believed that if a particle, if a particle went into a black hole and then whatever was radiated out, you couldn't tell what went into it. So now it kind of goes as it's going in, as it's coming, you know, as the black hole is forming, there's only really this very, you know, millisecond that you couldn't be able to tell what was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it starts to die again. And so particles can escape. And you'll be able to then inference what was destroyed or what went into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this whole of you have a large amount of data as the black hole is just starting to form. And then it goes very small amount of data. And then it goes back up to, as it's dying again, a large amount of data mm-hmm. of what you can tell of what it digested. That's... I think I'm reading a little into that, but that's kind of the more meaningful part of that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
All right.
Stephen Hawking is a genius, after all.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's because he eats his Wheaties in the mornings. All right.
That would be so funny to see a Wheaties box with Stephen Hawking on the front.
Yeah, that would be the coolest thing ever. I would actually go
and
buy a Wheaties.
I would get one of those, too. I've never collected Wheaties boxes, but I would get one of those.
I'd be a hardcore Wheaties fan.
Linus Tolverts eats Wheaties. Google's Fraud Squad battles Phantom Clicks. Now, this is something we talked about before, that it's hard for online advertising to take an account for. A lot of online advertising is based on cost per click. And the cost per click goes up and down, and also you have to pay per click. And those clicks cost money. So how do you know if those clicks are actually coming from a real person or a fake person? And that would be very bad for you if you're actually getting a lot of fake clicks and having to pay for it. There's a fatal flaw in the cost per click model because tons of marketing dollars can be depleted in a fraction of a second. Skipping all this information here. Basically, technology is continuing to be developed that can exploit this pricing model at incredibly high volumes. Yeah, the system's very vulnerable to these types of attacks. I'll list here. Click fraud is perpetuated in both automated and human ways. The most common method is the use of online robots or bots programmed to click on advertisers' links that are displayed on websites or listed in search queries. A growing alternative employs low-cost workers who are hired in China, India, and other countries to click on text links and other ads. A third form of fraud takes place when employees of a company click on rivals' ads to deplete their marketing budget and skew search results. So right there, that's a bad way to, it's a good way, but it's bad for the other people, to basically click the hell out of their advertisements and they have to pay for it. So it's a good way to run up thousands of dollars against your rivals. What's
Netscape has caused an error in Netscape.exe. Netscape will now close. If you continue to experience problems, try restarting your computer.
Yeah, about every 3 out of every 4 to 5 searches, I get that.
That is
nice
Netscape 4.7, ladies and gentlemen. How about round of applause?
All right. Hey, you got to give a hand to Netscape. Those guys have. Those guys
have
the leader.
Come a long way. They funded the Mozilla project.
Yeah, those guys are the leader. Then they got knocked out. I think they got a little depressed, and things are doing really well now with Mozilla and Netscape and all that stuff. Okay, well, this is the announcement of, well, it's been announced many times before, but the first announcement, Macintosh Gen 2 project that has just been released. Ooh. It's about in a year of development. Basically, it just gives you the Gen 2 portage system on top of Mac OS X, where you can actually install Linux applications and run that within Mac OS X. The portage system is a really flexible, fast system of getting different packages installed on your computer, packages being software. And also it looks for dependencies and anything else that it needs to successfully install the software on your machine. And they have that ready for Mac OS X. Now, they're not using the GCC compiler from Gen2. They're actually using Apple's version of GCC's compiler. Gen2's working on correcting their compiler to be able to work with that, to compile correctly for Mac OS X. And they have a few things that they're going to be doing in the future. They're busy polishing up the Cocoa interface of the software. Cocoa is actually the kind of the Windows toolkit for Mac OS X. So they're going to be doing an interface for that, and I think it's going to be really kick-ass to have that, because Mac OS X rocks, and being able to install very easily Linux applications that are actually you can get binary versions of them, or you can actually get the source code version of them. They're more popular with the source code, not very many binaries up there, and compiled for your system to work with efficiency.
You know, something like that has actually been around for a while. There was a version of apt for Debian that was released for OS X to install Linux applications very easy. I can't remember the name off the top of my head.
Yeah, this one didn't compile it and stuff like that.
Yeah,
it was just the binaries.
Gen2 compiles it, it configures it. Absolutely love Porridge. I'm a huge Gen2 fan, and now I just want a Mac even more.
Yeah, I want a Mac, but then I don't, because I look at what they cost.
Yeah.
So, going to have to say no to Macs, unfortunately.
Mac says no to me, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And why did they say no to you?
Because I'm 19.
And he wasn't able to buy one off their website for lots of money off credit.
Yeah.
Well, heck, you can go get a credit card and, you know.
Not with that kind of credit limit.
Oh, you can get two of them then. Then you just declare bankruptcy and you got a free computer.
All right. Then you can never buy a home or anything else.
Oh, no, you can do it after, you know, 7 years or so. Well, actually, in this economy, if after about a year or two, they're like, all right, you know, we'll give you credit again. Mm-hmm. You pay a little bit more, but...
Yeah, I'll just wait another 6 months and build up my credit and then...
There you go. Good patience.
Or I could just save up $1,500.
No one listened to VR's comments about bankruptcy there.
I get a little extreme with finances.
All right. And this is more information about voice over IP. Basically, it's a new technology. Well, it's maturing technology, let's put it that way. It's not exactly new anymore. Of how to get your voice over IP, which is basically the internet protocol, and making phone calls and such. There's a lot of insecurities in that. A lot of people have been exploiting those insecurities. Actually, there's going to be a few talks over at DEF CON about that. And there's quite a few papers out there on talking about some of the insecurities in voice over IP. You got to kind of hunt them down. They're not very available. Growing number of companies from startups to giants, such as AT&T, are pitching voice over IP in our protocol as a cheaper alternative to traditional service carried over 100-year-old infrastructure by companies including SBC Communications and Verizon Communications. But basically, there's a few downfalls to it. If you have an alarm system, need to dial 911, use TiVo, or simply want your phone number included in the phone book, you're likely to be out of luck. Also, if your power goes out, you won't be able to dial 911 or any emergency systems, and the phone will basically be dropped. A lot of times when you actually call a voice over IP service, you have to go through a third party to even get you the dial tone or the 911 service. You won't be able to do that. And there's also stuff out there that allows you to spoof your ANI, which is basically your caller ID information, and a few other nifty tricks that people are coming up as the technology is being explored that make it a new tool for freakers and hackers alike. Okay, moving right along. Wow. There's now no longer going to be internet access during the show.
Well, you know, once I actually get this thing functional, it shouldn't be a problem. But
yeah,
but right now, even Cyber here is a little, you know, has raised his eyebrows quite a few times at what's going on with my funky machine.
Wow. Yeah, gateways are not so good.
Well,
I think it's a gateway. I think it's Windows ME.
I think it's just the...
Because it's not a hardware problem, it's a software problem right now.
It's... Ooh, explore.
It's the software the gateway put on there that's making it bad.
Well, gateway did make that software, though.
Yeah. Click up where?
Well, do you guys want to postpone this? Because I don't think anyone on the show can actually see this laptop, so it's really not going to be a benefit.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah, we can do tech support after the show.
Okay.
We can do that.
I do tech support every day.
All right. Well, it's nighttime.
I've done it at night before, too. It was actually very interesting and boring.
And
at the same time.
And how am I supposed to go there?
No.
Don't worry about
Don't
it.
Worry about
okay,
it.
All right. Well,
do that
fine. Now that it's like getting her panties off, now I can't do anything. Thanks,
right.
Guys. You rock.
All right. The new stats for Doom 3 to be able to run it, the minimum stats here, are, well, not the minimum, but the recommended. It's a 1.5 gigahertz Pentium 4 chip, or AMD Athlon 1500, 384 megs of RAM, 2 gigabytes of hard drive space, an NVIDIA GeForce 3 graphics card or better, or an ATI Technologies 8500 or better. And that's about it. If you have a slower machine, though, the first thing you really want to go for is the video card.
That's actually not that bad. I was expecting the specs to be a lot higher.
Yeah, they did play it with the 1.5 gigahertz and like a GeForce 3, and it did quite fantastically.
I was expecting like a GeForce 4 or possibly even a GeForce FX.
I think the media hype of the grandeur of Doom 3 has made it
sound
beyond, but obviously it's going to be a very good game.
I actually thought that they were going to release like its own special video card that was like 4 times better than anything else, and they were going to ship that with the game. The game was going to cost about $450, and you had to have this video card to play it because that's how good they made it sound.
Yeah, you know, it probably wouldn't be a good idea to do that because a lot of parents are going to be like, okay, here, cool, here's Doom 3, but Mom, we want a new PC with it, and they'll be like, sorry, bub. And then you're going to have a lot of people that are going to be playing Doom 3 with if it needed that kind of quality of processing power and stuff like that, the quality of the game would not be very exciting and be hard to play against with other players on the internet and stuff like that, possibly, because it would just need so much. But the 1.5 gigahertz with the GeForce 3 actually ran pretty well.
I wonder if they'll be releasing a Linux client for Doom 3.
Oh, it's already done.
Oh, they are?
Yeah, it's not done. I mean, it's going to come out at the same time.
Sweet. They've been doing that a lot with games recently. I'm actually pretty stoked about that. Being able to play games like Unreal 2004, that game was awesome.
You know, I didn't really like that too much. It was kind of like, you know, just spray and pray kind of game.
Well, yeah, but every once in a while, it's nice to have a spray and pray kind of game where you can just go and shoot and die and respawn instantly and go shoot someone.
Yeah. Actually, I've never really found much interest in those games.
Really?
If they had, I don't really like that. I like, actually, if it was like Unreal Tournament, like if it was like the normal Unreal where you actually go through these levels.
Yeah.
And, you know,
Unreal was pretty fun.
Worlds
too.
And stuff like that, and you know, have to attack monsters and stuff like that. That's kind of more fun than.
I'm into the tactical games too. Don't get me wrong, but every once in a while, you just gotta spray and pray.
Yeah, see, I'm just a big fan of like going out and really playing paintball. That's like the whole computer thing of like playing a game. Not that great a thing. I want to feel some paint.
Right. Well, you could always actually put clothespins on your balls.
You could hook some diodes up to your computer, and every time you get hit, just zap yourself.
That would probably be interesting.
What'd you say?
I said he could hook like some diodes or something up to his computer.
Oh, I thought you said he could play while he was on dial-up. That would be a little painful.
That would be painful as well.
All right. Well, moving along yet again. The technical breakdown nearly stops the Tribune presses. The Chicago Tribune, which hasn't missed an episode since the Great Fire of 1871, came perilously close to doing so just Monday, which was back on late July. Because of the computer breakdown, about 40% of the subscribers received no paper Monday, and that those that did get the paper got a truncated version with strange page numbering and unusual placement of some features. The problems occurred after a flaw in software installed over the weekend crashed in the newspaper's production system. After struggling through the night, the newspaper managed to, at daybreak, to begin printing an abbreviated Monday paper. Normally, the Tribune's presses begin running out about midnight, and it takes at least 3 hours to print nearly 600,000 Monday copies. But because of Sunday night's difficulties, the press didn't begin rolling out until 5:30 a.m. The Tribune's Red Eye tabloid edition also went out very late. By midday, the paper could receive had received more than 40,000 phone calls from angry and confused subscribers. It was the highest single day of complaint total I'm aware of, said Dick Malone, the Tribune's senior vice president and general manager. We're very disappointed to have inconvenienced so many of our customers, Malone said at a news conference. Tribune publisher and president Scott C. Smith told employees in a memo that the estimated cost of resolving the problem included credits to subscriptions and who didn't get a paper, and advertisers whose ads didn't appear will be under $1 million.
Ooh.
The printing problem at the Chicago Tribune were related to efforts to upgrade computer equipment used to produce the newspaper. Malone said the Tribune acquired customized software from an upgrade from an outside provider, and it contained a coding error. You know, I would charge that company.
I wonder if that software they installed was Windows ME.
I doubt it, but I would charge that company, whoever put that software together for them, quite a bit of money.
Yes, I would as well.
Yeah.
Now, the fact that if they could do that or not, not sure. Most likely, I think so, but it definitely would be an interesting court battle.
Maybe it'll be like the SCO thing. We'll be talking about it for a year to come.
Pretty much. Actually, I don't know. That thing seems to be tapering off right now. They've ran out of bullets to fire.
That they have.
Off in the news. Okay. Moving along yet again, the distraction of VR. I don't get your comments now, sir.
Well, you know what? The other day you actually were saying that I needed to, you know, tone down my comments. So.
Well, no. Tone down some of the audacity of some stuff.
Well, that's just not as much fun.
I know it's not as much fun. But it doesn't really leave much. Well, that's another thing.
Yeah, it doesn't leave me talking very much at all, so.
Okay. All right. Well,
but I'm actually being incredibly successful right now. So I'm feeling really good about myself.
All right.
And so here in a minute, I'll probably be my lively, interactive self again.
What's the website?
Actually, I'm finally being able to download an upgraded version of Netscape. So I might be actually be able to upgrade some other things more effectively.
Uh-huh.
Which is pretty silly.
You know, if you were here last night and you brought your laptop, we could have got you all fixed up.
Yeah, we could have.
I know. Then you missed when the girls came, too.
Yeah, the strippers were awesome.
Uh-huh. And, you know, they were for the next-door neighbor, right?
No. No, they were the next-door neighbor.
Oh.
That would be so funny if our next-door neighbors listened to In and Out.
Oh, man.
Well, they probably do through the wall, but...
No, actually, these places are pretty good. Actually, we don't even have anybody that's a neighbor to us. We just have someone that's below us.
I actually think there might be, like, a dead body rotting in there, because there's always bugs all over that door.
Well, then you better stop licking the door. No. All right. Get back on track.
All right.
All right, well, the new iPod is on its way to coming out.
There's another new iPod?
Things upgrade.
Oh, my.
That would be an iPod.
I hope it's better this time.
I was just saving up to get the old iPod. Then I'm going to have to wait
another
year.
If it's not better than the iRiver, I'm sorry. It's just not worth it.
The iPod rocks, dude.
Dude, the iRiver is an iPod times 4.5 billion.
Wow.
Wow.
That's an astronomical number. No, actually, I can't.
All right, well, basically,
a smart person.
The new iPod comes with more efficient menus, new features. Basically, you can create multiple on-the-go playlists and delete songs from those ad hoc mixes, and audiobooks are easier to find. And you can also listen to them at normal speed, slower or 25% faster without it sounding like...
Wait, so I can have my iPod read to me?
No.
There's audiobooks on there, right?
It doesn't read it to you. It plays a sound file that happens to be someone reading a book.
Jeez, get all uptight on the semantics.
What is reading to you? Longer play, coast to coast, coast to coast.
You need a big chair there, CyberBob.
You get 12 hours of battery time off the iTunes. And basically, it actually has a lower price. The top of the line iTunes holding, or iPod holding 10,000 songs, basically 40 gigs. Now costs $3.99. The 20 gigs is $2.99, and there's a $100 price reduction for each. Oh no, that's a $100 price reduction for each. Okay, and there is no more 15 gig models. So the cheapest one is $2.99. It's got a little slimmer design and function a little bit better and stuff like that. So
I think I'm actually going to wait to buy a new MP3 player until they come out with a solid state player that has a decent amount of storage. Because that's really what I want. I had a hard drive MP3 player before, and I wasn't really a fan of it.
Hmm.
Right on.
Well, 10,000 songs is quite a bit of play.
The crystalline structure?
No. I'm talking like, I'm in my truck, which the suspension and shocks are horrible, and I'm bouncing around with my hard drive MP3 player, and it skips.
Ooh, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, so I want a solid state MP3 player. Which basically means no moving parts.
Yeah,
no,
I know. Yeah,
okay, just making sure.
That's the crystalline structure kind of thing.
Okay.
That's what they were looking to do for a while there. I'm not sure if they're still pursuing that or not, but it's kind of an interesting technology.
I remember they actually came out with this one. I believe it was a Zen or something. It's got a 4 gigabyte IBM micro drive in it. I remember when it first came out, they were charging $199 for it, and they were selling this micro drive for $600 retail. So people were buying these Zen MP3 players and cracking them open just for the micro drive.
Wow.
And selling them on eBay for like $400.
So at a $200 loss, they break the thing and resell it.
Yeah. No, at a $200 gain.
Oh.
They buy the MP3 player for $200. They get the $600 hard drive out of it. They sell it for $400.
Oh, okay. See, I just got the $600 there and the $200. There we go. That's great.
All right. Yeah. Moving along. I don't know. I like the iTunes. Actually, I forget what it's called, the FM radio transmitter that's on there. You can play the iTunes in your car, on your radio, anywhere you want to take it to. I'm actually not a really big music person where I carry around 18,000 songs on me at all times. I really actually am very choice on my selection of music at that time. But I guess it's good to have a big fat library of songs. A copyright
fat library.
A copyright bill to kill tech. The Senate Judiciary Committee will consider a bill Thursday back in late July that will hold, well, not back in late July, it's still late July, Thursday that would hold technology companies liable for any product that they make that encourages people to steal copyright materials. Critics say the bill would effectively outlaw peer-to-peer networks and prohibit the development of new technologies, including devices like iPod. The inducing infringement of copyright acts was introduced last month by Senator Orrin Hatch, basically a Republican from Utah, head of the Senate Judiciary Committee. The legislation would hold a company liable that intentionally induces a person to infringe copyright. We think this is a recipe for disaster for the Internet, said Mark Erickson, general counsel to the Net Coalition, a public policy group that represents Internet companies like Google, Yahoo, and Internet service providers. The bill, as it is currently drafted, is extremely broad and not entirely clear. It would, at minimum, undermine the Sony Betamax decision. In the Betamax decision, the Supreme Court ruled that any technology that people use for legal purposes would be legal if the device could be used for illegal purposes like content piracy. Because of the ruling, the consumer electronics industry in Hollywood went to develop a thriving market in home video and DVDs. This takes an objective standard and replaces it with a subjective one that allows the copyright holder to try and determine the intent of the company when producing a product, Erickson said. It's not outside the realm of possibility that you would be placing the entertainment industry in charge of technological innovation if this law were passed. It's the biggest threat to technology within 20 years, said Jeff Joseph, a spokesman for the Consumer Electronics Association. The organization's president will testify before the committee. The Judiciary Committee will also hear testimony from Register of Copyrights, Mayor Beth Peters, and the heads of the Business Software Alliance and Recording Industry Association of America. The representative said the IEEE's USA Intellectual Property Committee and the director of the Net Coalition will also testify. One supporter of the bill, RIAA Chief Mitch Bainwall, is expected to include information about the music trade group's recent settlement with iMesh, a company that makes file trading software, in his testimony on Tuesday. The RIAA announced that iMesh agreed to pay record companies $4.1 million for copyright infringement. The company also said it would modify its business to prevent consumers from illegally sharing or downloading songs. Critics said the bill is the wrong fix for the piracy problem. This bill really creates a huge risk that people won't bring new products to market because they'll be afraid to be sued out of existence, said Mike Goodwill, legal director of Public Knowledge, which is opposed to the bill and is submitting written testimony to the committee. We keep asking, what's the rush? It's not clear that everything has to be wrapped up in the summer of 2004. Goodwin and Senate Judiciary staff are eager to get the legislation moving because they are worried that the Federal Appeals Court in California will uphold an April 2003 court decision that did not hold peer-to-peer companies liable for their users' copyright infringement. The so-called Grokster case also argued before the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in February. A decision is expected soon. So I wanted to read that whole article because there's a lot of things going on there. But that basically sounds like a very bad bill. And probably 10 different reasons why it's a bad thing.
Well, it just gives them so much power.
Yeah, which is really what it's all about. But I mean,
how would they pass a bill that didn't?
How could they really? Well, not all bills give people power, actually. But how could they charge somebody, a company, for making the device? You know what I mean? Like, as far as,
well, then you get into like, you know, that. Anybody gets shot by a gun, they can sue the gun manufacturer.
It's just too hard to be able to define what is going to be abusive technology and what isn't going to be abusive technology when it does have legal purposes. And
well, any tool can have positive or negative uses. Or
absolutely. You could take a TiVo and bash somebody upside the head, you know. So do you actually get to sue TiVo because it's a device you could use to give concussions?
It's a bludgeoning device.
yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely ridiculous. Let me pull that back.
It's a good day to be a lawyer when that bill gets passed.
Every day is a good day
to be
a lawyer.
Every day is a good day to be a lawyer.
Well, it's exceptional because then you can, like, you know, screw two people at the same time.
So I hope that doesn't get passed. I'm surprised I didn't see anything in there from the EFF in the article. Maybe that's just because they didn't have any people speak to the EFF. Let me see here. How's that laptop going along?
It is so much better now. I just was able to actually, like, you know, go to Mozilla.org without it having crashed.
Wow.
It's amazing. Nice. And what's funny now is I realized that I was going to Mozilla to get an upgrade version of Netscape.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what else.
No, you want Firefox, my friend.
You want Firefox.
Oh, I want Firefox?
Yes, you want Firefox. All right,
then I'll download Firefox.
You do that.
Oh, there it is. Download.
All right.
Yeah.
We are achieving major technical
feats. Firefox is code name for porn, which is why he's so excited.
Oh, man.
Oh.
All right, well, that bill actually needs to be really looked at by everyone in the community and contribute wherever possible to help make sure that that doesn't happen.
Yes, send a letter to your congressman saying no to this bill.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not only that, but everybody that has the ability to help influence such things needs to really get in there because that thing is just absolutely ridiculous and it's not going to help anything. And in my belief, I do not believe that that will go through. I believe that maybe there will be some sort of thing that goes along somewhere else in, like, you know, the next DMCA upgrade or something like that to where, you know, if devices have specific features that are only built, a feature that is only for illegal use, then they'll pass it. But I don't think that they'll be able to pass something like that. If they do, it'll be passive ignorance, and it'll be a sad world to live in at that point.
DMCA version 2.0?
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Point. Release candidate 2.
I'll have to get a new DMCA toilet paper roll.
Yeah. Because we used it last night. Okay, also, Microsoft is expanding its access to the Windows source code, which I think is a good thing. Microsoft Corp has expanded the source licensing program under which its most valuable professionals get access to the source code for the Windows operating system. The Redmond, Washington company said on Monday that all the MVPs within the Microsoft Platforms community is living with 27 eligible countries worldwide will now be able to access Windows source code at no cost. Now, this is only portions of it, so it's not the whole thing. The source code provided under the program covers Microsoft Windows 2000, XP, Windows Server 2003, and future versions of Windows operating systems, including all release versions, service packs, betas, and subsequent releases. I don't believe it's all of the code, though. It's just portions of the code from those operating systems. But I may be wrong. MVPs who are chosen have a unique set of expertise and passion around the Microsoft technologies and who are recognized for their contributions to online and technical communities already have access to the source components for Windows CE.NET, ASP.NET, Visual Studio.NET, and Passport Manager.
I hope some of those people are going to be looking at that source code dedicated to finding bugs and fixing them.
That would be nice.
Yes, it would.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure that they already have plenty of people doing that because they're really trying to jump on the ball for the whole security thing, and they have quite a few tens of millions of lines of code that they have not really combed over with a fine tooth comb for years now, and I think they're trying to jump on that now, so I really think they are moving towards trying to make security a more a larger goal than they have in the past. And the Windows XP Service Pack 2, I do believe, comes with a lot of things that are going to try to help that out in the beginning. But it's just a big step of many steps that I think they're going to take. So I'm actually going to give some sort of congratulations to Microsoft for trying. And you know what? The problem is that they only did it out of being forced to. So that's the problem. Nonetheless, it's slowly being done. Spammer loses case filed by Microsoft. Microsoft Corp was awarded $3.95 million in a lawsuit against a man accused of sending millions of spam messages to lure email users to a website that allegedly used a Microsoft trademark. Judge Manuel Real of U.S. District Court of the Central District of California ordered Daniel Knopfschnud of Kanaga Park, California, to pay Microsoft for violating the company's trademark and profiting from the use of domain names controlled by Microsoft.
Ooh.
Pointcom Inc. and Joshua Then Investments, two companies managed by Mr. Kushnud, were also named in the suits along with 10 others. According to court's documents, Mr. Kushnud managed two email campaigns that lured consumers into downloading a toolbar that it claimed would automatically update Microsoft security patches. To get the toolbar, the users were directed to WindowsUpdate.com, a domain name that Mr. Kushnud had registered in violation of Microsoft's trademark rights, the judge said. Microsoft produces the widely used Windows computer operating system, well, we know that. The judge ordered last week was not directly connected to the amount of email Mr. Kushnud sent, but Microsoft officials said he sent millions of unsolicited email messages to its MSN and Hotmail users, and that the website and toolbar were noticed by Microsoft after complaints by customers. More of that stuff going on. People getting busted, companies attacking people, on all sorts of new crimes that can be committed out there, or nuances that are being created.
Just a new kind of corporate warfare. The battle between consumers and corporations and independents.
Yeah, has never been larger than today, actually. And the fact that, you know, it's funny because we have freedom in this country, but, you know, that is being more defined daily. And then just besides just going out and telling the world how you feel about things, the products that you bring into your own home are now telling you how you are to be within those products' boundaries, which I'm not very excited about. And
yeah, that's completely understandable, where you have what is a tool that you've purchased or you're using being your master. It's kind of a role reversal. So it's a little disturbing where you, it's like the slave becomes the master.
Yeah, well, you're you know, you are the bitch to all the companies out there, and you know, I don't really know, you know, it's just, you just have to keep supporting alternate ways of doing things, and I don't know, if the things just become too much of a headache, just try to move to some place where you don't have to deal with it. That's really my suggestion. This is something we kind of talked about before, and I'm still really worried about it happening in the future. Actually, I said from reading a few things that this was the reason why it was being done. Microsoft has been running all these copyrights for all these technologies. Now, one of the reasons that they can run these copyrights for technologies that they want to get created and patented and stuff like that is so that rival companies don't sue them saying that they had it first. So that's one of the business aspects that they're trying to cover. But also, it could be used against free software, open source software that actually has these types of technologies created. And Microsoft is the first one to copyright it, or any other company for that matter, and to say, hey, you can't do that. The GPL license has no bearing when it comes to the copyright law. We already own that technology, so you can't use it. Funny thing is, my belief system is that open source software actually has so many more things out there being created on a daily basis that hasn't even touched the Windows platform yet. So it's going to be a very sad day when this type of vulnerability starts coming into place and taking out some of the technologies that I think has been developed by hardworking people way prior to Microsoft patents. An HP memo forecasts MS patent attacks on free software. A two-year-old memo from Hewlett-Packard executive Gary Campbell to other Hewlett-Packard execs has been wending its way around the back rooms of the Internet this weekend, basically last weekend, before its submission had been. We held off publishing the memo until we verified its authenticity and gave HP a second chance to respond. The memo, its full text provided later in the story, along with Hewlett-Packard's response, briefly explains a patent cross-licensing deal between HP and Microsoft. By itself, that's not a big deal, especially since it has been sent 2 years ago, but the memo asserts that Microsoft will soon be launching a patent-based legal offensive against Linux and other free software projects. Leaders in the open source community have been watching warning of such attacks for some time. The memo reveals that there may be a very good reason for the worry. According to Campbell's memo, the GPL itself invites such an attack, he wrote, but it probably doesn't matter because the GPL license has a mutually assured destruction clause in Section 7. If anyone is sued over patent infringement, no one is licensed under the GPL to ship GPL products. That is probably what Microsoft intends to do. Basically, Microsoft is going to use the legal system to shut down open source software, and for all of its cleverness, the GPL makes it fairly easy unless a white knight steps in. Although the patent attacks have still not been launched, some speculate that it is only a matter of time. One well-known figure in the open source community, beginning on the condition of anonymity, told us, Microsoft has had to hold off due to antitrust prosecution in the EU and US, and they also didn't want to create bad news for the European software patent laws before they got what they wanted. Now they have to respond. They have the prospect of being able to prosecute the same patents in Europe. My suspicion is that we could see this commercial this started very soon, or hold off for up to 3 years while Microsoft establishes its commercial licensing program. If they wait to get around 10,000 licenses in their commercial program, they will be able to show in court what they license, that they license the patents reasonably, and that will make them more difficult to fight.
Ooh,
man, I hope they don't get away with that.
As Campbell's inner speculation of Section 7 of the GPL, we asked Professor Eben Molgan of the Columbia Law School, he also acts as a Free Software Foundation's general counsel, if he felt Campbell was reading the GPL correctly, he replied, The interpretation of Section 7 presented in the supposed memo is not correct. The filing of the lawsuit alleging patent infringement places obligations on no one under Section 7. The license says that if restrictions imposed on you mean that you cannot afford others all the freedoms apparently conveyed by GPL, you can't use the license. The examples given in the Section 7 are judgments, interim relief, preliminary injunction, etc., or accepted licenses. Someone's allegations of infringement, whether made judicially or otherwise, do not impose conditions and do not trigger Section 7. Mistaken about the GPL or not, Campbell was obviously alarmed at what he had learned of Microsoft's intentions. Perhaps he was a victim of FUD, or perhaps the issue will resurface later after we all figure it has gone away.
That sounds more like it than, you know, maybe the law professor, well, the Microsoft's lawyers have interpreted the same way that he did, and that they can shut it all down. And so when I'll let the pond settle back down, and then they'll do it. Kind of a scary idea.
Yeah, you know, there is a response that, you know, the open source community could do is also make patents as well. Well, no, they can't, because the GPL doesn't really work that well. If you patent the software, what if they had a special patent for the GPL that says, like, well, of the GPL community, we did make this software beforehand, so if anyone wants to come along and say that they have rights to it, then they can just back off.
Yeah, I kind of like that idea.
That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. There should be some kind of record that it was created within the open source community, and if somebody else patented it, you know, copyrighted or patented it, you know, that's great. They're just stealing, and so.
Can they legally do that? Something released under the GPL license has to be re-released under the GPL license.
No, that's if you use the same source code, not the idea.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just the source code.
And with the Millennium copyright.
This idea thing is just...
Yeah, it's just asinine.
Well, the idea of open source actually is not a system that totally coincides with patenting and copyrights and stuff like that. It's more of a system of, like, you know, dare I say, mixing communism with capitalism. It's not really meant to work the way that traditional businesses are meant to work. You know, people can sell, they can do capitalism off of open source by selling a box and a CD set and support, but, and they can charge whatever price they wish. But, the source is still available for anyone to grab and make it freely available, at any point in time. But, the fact, I do believe this is a major weakness in the, or not a weakness, a major, yeah, a major weakness in the way that the GPL can be addressed, as far as if somebody patents the technology before something that GPL has patented. And actually, patenting something that GPL really isn't designed in the standard outlook of how that software is supposed to be... you know, warranted, as far as, you know, if it's open source, if you patent it, you know, somebody's going to modify it and patent it again, and it's going to be an endless process. It's going to restrict, it can either restrict development or, well, it won't totally restrict development. They would have to just make patents all the time. And actually, it depends on the Microsoft one, how they patent it. If they write it to be exactly like something that's in the open source, it's a very complex issue. If something Microsoft patents, it has to be exactly the way that it's implemented in its open source alternative. But the open source alternative could always modify it a little bit and just be a little bit different. And then they, you know, depending on how much of the difference, they could go to court and go to war on it. But
but then you're talking code instead of an idea.
Well, the code produces the idea. So
it'd be really nice if the Federal Trade Commission got involved in that and said, you can't do that because you're taking over too much of the market share.
I think they should just release a new version of the GPL that prevents that. I'm no lawyer, but I think there should be some way to tie that into the GPL, because everything released under the GPL says GPL version whatever or latest.
Yeah, so it's essentially already copyrighted.
Yeah, everything under the GPL would be covered by whatever they release as the latest version of the GPL. If they could think of something to cover that.
Well, it's not copyrighted. But it is a licensed work.
Well, there you go. Close enough.
And it's the idea of, does copyright take precedence over licensed work? And the idea is expressed therein. And also, does copyright have the ability to, you know, whatever is open source is an evolving process anyways. There's a lot to it. But all honestly, yeah, you know, VR said it probably best. The way that would be attacked is that people would come out and be like, hey, Microsoft, you know, we're not too happy. We think you're abusing this, and you can't do that. You know, and then that will take, you know, that can take precedence over everything else. And it's insanely complex an issue. Very complex issue. I don't know if anything over at GNU.org actually addresses that. But I'm sure if things like that start happening from Microsoft, I'm sure the creative minds out there will definitely come up with a defense.
I just think it's ridiculous that someone can steal someone's idea and copyright it just because they have more money.
Yeah, well, money breeds power, but also consumers have a lot of power themselves.
They have the most power, because if you don't buy it, they don't make it.
Unfortunately, 90% of the consumers buy Windows.
Yeah.
Well, it's just available to them, mm-hmm. So they grab it. But, you know, they do have a lot of power if people rise up and say they don't like it. And
I don't think it's so much that it's available to them. It's more being crammed down their throats by the computers that they buy.
Well, that's the same thing. Yeah, well, it's not the same thing, but yeah, it goes along with what I meant. The thing is, you know, the general consensus on Microsoft, people are always complaining about the spyware installed in it, the problems with it, the bugs, the glitches, all this crap. Everyone I talk to, and I mean, these are just normal Joe-Blow people, because I have a business that goes out and handles people's computers and technologies and stuff like that, and I just get that all the time. Those are just always what the calls are about. That's just always what the problem is, you know, 80 to 90% of the time, and people are probably going to get sick of it. I don't know if they're very excited about Macintoshes or Linux or anything like that just yet, but they're definitely... if they had something that they could get that worked just as well, in their minds of ease and in usability, they would definitely
well mainly compatibility, and then that's what they're used to, and that's yeah they go from continuity from one machine to another.
I agree with VR. I think it's a total compatibility issue.
Yeah, and that's the war that's being waged. There are plenty of people on open source that just want to develop what they just feel like developing. Maybe there's no mm-hmm. political guidelines to it, but obviously there's a lot of people out there that have a little bit of political guidelines to it and are looking for an alternative and developing one, so that's what's being created.
Yeah, because it really, you know, it kind of sucks having to go from, like, you know, like Microsoft that you learn to, you know, you have to know whatever you're trying to do, there's a certain process for it, and then if you go to a Mac, there's a completely different process to do the same thing. And so and being a human being and being intrinsically, you know, technologically lazy, you know, organism, because we don't want to do a lot of process to do the same thing.
I don't know. I think the ease of use is pretty much on par nowadays.
Yeah, but if you have to do, you have to.
If anything breaks under the hood, though, they're going to know that they could go under the hood, and they're going to say, I don't know anything under the hood.
Yeah.
Microsoft is like, under the hood is, you know, right click, you know, and finding another menu, you know. So then they'll be in their minds that this is way more complex, you know. Well, the complexity is there because you're given more control. But a lot of stuff is...
With great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah, and actually, what's the quote? Should I read that?
Oh, the syllogism?
Yeah, should I do that?
Oh, you might as well, and then we can get out of here.
All right. This is Captain Alibaba's favorite quote. nothing is better than sex. Masturbation is better than nothing. Therefore, masturbation is better than sex. Just okay. That was just something I found out there on the internet. This is a website that links.
That's the kind of websites that Slips looks at.
No, this is one of the websites that actually linked to my website, along with AsianBeaver.org.
AsianBeaver.org, yes, a very good site. I recommend you go visit it.
I don't, but but Captain Alibaba does. All right. Well, you have heard another edition of the In the Now show.
I actually have one more thing to say before we go. DEF CON is next weekend. Plans are looking good at me being there. Hopefully I will be there.
And if you are a raging fan for Captain Alibaba, he will be bringing t-shirts and Sharpies to sign them.
Yeah, but if anybody actually wants to meet up and hang out, you can just drop me a line on the slipnet.org forums. I'll be checking them. And I will be at DEF CON, hopefully.
All right.
I will see you all there.
Okay. I think that's it for me.
I'm spent.
I'm exhausted. All right. Long day. All right. Well, that was the July 25th edition show. And we'll see everyone in 2 weeks.
Later.
See you then.
Captain Alibaba out.